Hello and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. This is Mark Williams talking to you from sunny Cambridge in the UK. My guest today is Patrick Ryan, Senior Vice President for Engineering and Technology at ABS, the American Classification Society. Patrick is responsible for global engineering, digital engineering, rules and software, research and development, and the Global Ship Systems Group. He and his team at ABS help ship owners, designers and builders bring their plans into the digital world. He's a naval architect. He's always been focused on big ships for over 20 years prior to joining ABS. He was in a design and construction role at Newport News Shipbuilding, where he was at the forefront of their digital transformation. He founded the Digital Innovation Lab, led the development and implementation of several new technologies, including Digital Twin, for several major shipbuilding programs. And he held a senior position in corporate strategy, where he wrote several of that company's digital strategies. He is a member of the Society of Naval Architects and Marine Engineers. He has a bachelor's degree in aerospace and ocean engineering and a master's degree in ocean engineering, all from Virginia Tech. So, Patrick, great to have you on the show. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you, Mark. I'm a fan of the podcast. I have listened to it, and I am very excited to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on, and you're actually our third guest from a classification society, so it's always great to get the view from where you sit, and particularly with you as a digitalization expert, and I do want to come back to that later on. But first of all, could you tell us your perspective of the role of class in the decarbonization discussion, please?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Yeah, that's a great place to start. So I have listened to both Mr. Philippe from BV and Mr. Haskell's from LR's podcast on your show, and I think they answered this very same starting out question very well. I would like to add to what they've put in the content that the role of class relative to decarbonization is about being that trusted partner. Yes, there are the regulatory pieces, there are the survey pieces, but really, I think, especially in 2022, it's about benchmarking. It's about helping our clients prepare for the upcoming 2030, 2050 requirements. And getting ready for that very difficult path we have in front of us. And I think being kind of that neutral third party is and that honest broker is the real role that class is playing today.
And that's very much the role that class has played pre-decarbonization. It's what class does, isn't it? It's that trusted partner role.
That's right. And it all goes back to the mission, right? The mission of safety, the mission of protection of the environment. Decarbonization plugs right into that protection of the environment piece. And then, of course, there's the demand that society is putting on the industry and all industries about decarbonizing. And that carries with it regulations and then the role of class as a recognized organization to help clients through the regulatory process and get their approvals is, of course, what we're focused on in 2022.
Yeah. And does class have an agnostic view about the regulations? You know, do you say, okay, these are the regulations, let's do our best to help you implement them? Or can class take a stand and say, we think the regulations are good or we think they're bad? Because you have a role, class has a role, for instance, at IMO, doesn't it?
It does, of course. And we have our regulatory affairs division that supports IMO and participates on many of the panels that influence the regulations. But I try to, you know, personally, and I talk to my team about, you know, staying above kind of the politics of where you are in decarbonization. I mean, it's what society is asking. And our role is to help the industry along. So, you know, to the large degree, as I lead a technology organization, as we talk about alternative fuels, as we talk about carbon capture, as we talk about wind energy, I mean, these are all very exciting things. And we are going to see more change, I think, in our industry in the next decade than we have in the last 100 years. The industry has always seen change, whether it's, you know, sails to steam, coal to oil, you know, iron to steel, shipping, shipbuilding, ship design is no stranger to innovation. Mm-hmm. But this period of innovation is particularly unique and I think particularly important from a societal perspective.
Quite so. So that leads me on to my next question very neatly, actually. So thank you for that. From your perspective, then, where's the industry standing today relative to where we want to get to in the decarbonization journey, which, of course, is full decarbonization as soon as possible after 2050?
Yeah, I think the milestones have been set. Right? So we know where we need to get to. The challenge is, how do we get there? Right? And I think, you know, by and large, we see a pathway to 2030 through LNG, particularly in dual fuel. And I think we're on a way to get there But the pathway to 2050 is a little cloudier. The way, in my opinion, to drive innovation, you start with learning, then you set standards, then you get to a mode of continuous improvement, which begets transformation, which begets innovation. And I think we're in kind of those first two steps now. We're in this kind of learning and the development of standards. And when I say learning, you know, I think back on 2021, about what a huge year it was for prototypes. Class participates, we call them at ABS joint development projects, or JDPs. If you read about us in the press, you'll see us announcing our JDPs all the time. But it's really about collaborating with clients, bringing good ideas together and learning, right? And developing that foundation of knowledge that we really need as an industry to push forward and make these goals. I look back, even in the recent weeks, even today, we announced our first dual fuel Newcastle Max bulk carrier with Eastern Pacific, took on its first LNG bunker fuel in Singapore. Yep. Last week, we had our first ammonia fuel ready vessel in the world. It was a Suez Max tanker developed by the owners, Avon, flying the Greek flag. And the week before that, it was a methanol fueled Neo Panamax bulk carrier designed with a JDP with us and Sidari. And so every week we're seeing an announcement. Every week we're seeing, you know, pushing the envelope forward, learning something, right? New prototypes, new joint development projects. And that's where I would say the state of the industry is, right? In this kind of learning phase and building that foundation that we need to get to where we need to get to in the next couple of decades.
Yeah. And as you say, there are developments along many different parallel paths towards that milestone. So you have the different fuels, you've got different types of ship design, different projects, joint development projects in your jargon, in your terminology, excuse me. Out of those, I mean, I always ask people this, and you know, you're allowed to say I don't know, but out of the different fuel alternatives that you see, you know, do you have a favorite? Do you have one that you think, yeah, that stands the best chance, you know, of getting us to where we want to go?
So, certainly, I think everyone in the industry has the same answer to this question. If I knew that, I'd be a wealthy man, right? I think that, as I say, it was that pathway still remains cloudy to us for the long term. But I will tell you that the landscape continues to change. 3 years ago, when I was talking about ammonia, nobody wanted to talk about ammonia. Ammonia was scary. It was toxic. Nobody knew how to handle it. And today we're talking about ammonia all the time, right? We had, as I just mentioned, 2 weeks ago, we had an ammonia fuel ready notation issue. And so that has come a long way. I think in the end, the solution to decarbonization is going to be a hybrid approach. Mm-hmm. Developing the amount of bunkering for any particular fuel type that society deems the right solution is going to be a massive, massive undertaking. And so I think you're going to see the results of the trial period for multiple fuels linger for a long time, because that infrastructure will be very expensive to put in place, and no one's going to want to tear it down. So there's going to be elements of all of the fuels going forward for a long time. And as we think about, when I say a hybrid solution, it's not just about fuels, right? We got to think about also energy storage, electrification aboard the vessels. And as we move forward from carbon-based fuels to pure green fuels, hydrogen or ammonia, what roles do those have to play? And then we talk about, of course, if you're still using carbon-based fuels, the role of carbon capture. As shipboard carbon capture becomes more of a something that we talk about, how can that actually change the way your ship is designed and operated? And then, of course, you've got energy efficiency devices, whether it's Flettner rotors or hull optimization or mm-hmm. skins, coatings that reduce your frictional drag. I mean, lots of things are going to come to play to really grab the efficiency goals that are needed to make those decarbonization targets.
Yeah. So when we you know, where we are today, as you say, is in that learning and development phase. When you look over the horizon, it's hard to look over the horizon, but when we try to look beyond the horizon relative to the energy issues for how we generate energy for our vessels, get it onto our vessels, store it on our vessels, burn it or consume it on our vessels, what do you think are the big issues that we're going to face? You know, we've got our candidates for energy sources, and we understand that there's going to be infrastructure issues around them, which shipping can't invest in by itself. But from a ship naval design specific perspective, perhaps, what do you see over the horizon? What are we going to get to next when we get to the next stage?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We talk about that all the time in the technology organization here at ABS. You know, what's next? How can we be ready for what's next? You know, we've issued a lot of fuel-related guides, advisories, and notations in 2021. The focus this year is more on those things like carbon capture and sequestration. And of course, hydrogen is a big topic, whereas it was kind of a whisper last year, and we're shouting it on the floor this year. And how do we get to not only, you know, low or zero tank to wake carbon with hydrogen fuel, but it has the potential for a zero well to wake fuel. So, of course, we're doing a project that was recently announced with Hyundai Heavy Industries in and around this area. And certainly we are interested in alternatives for how are we producing, even in our offshore markets with offshore wind, that hydrogen fuel or ammonia fuel that will deliver that zero well to wake solution that really we need to get to. If there's a tremendous amount of carbon produced in the production of hydrogen fuels, we really are running to stand in place. I think I heard that from one of my contemporaries in their podcast, right? And I think where we really need to go is zero from start to finish. And I think if you're using wind to generate the electricity, to produce the electrolysis, to produce the hydrogen fuel, and there's no carbon in that equation, then I think you're onto something. And I would mention, you know, when we think about kind of the energy densities needed to produce that much hydrogen, perhaps there is even a role for one of my favorite technologies in nuclear power to mm-hmm. generate the electricity potentially offshore to produce the hydrogen that the industry needs to truly operate.
So that's an interesting innovation. You know, people have talked about nuclear-powered ships. There were a few launched back in the golden age of atomic power in the 50s and 60s. I think the United States had one, Japan had one, Germany had one. They never really went anywhere because of accidents and the popular perception of the dangers of nuclear power. Michael Bowe is promoting nuclear-powered ships at the moment. He's a sort of known name in the industry. But nobody's really getting anywhere with it. But this idea that you've just presented of maybe using nuclear power to generate zero carbon hydrogen or hydrogen type fuels offshore, which could then be put onto ships, that's a perspective that I haven't heard recently. Do you can you tell us any more about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I read it. It was in a periodical recently. I'm not going to claim that as an idea, but certainly, you know, as we struggle with where does nuclear power fit in the broader spectrum. Mm-hmm. I designed nuclear powered ships for 20 years at Newport News. That's what we built, right? Nuclear powered military ships. Of course, the Savannah is the ship you were searching for in the American commercial vessel.
Yeah, that was the one. Thanks.
Was something that was Adams for Peace back in the Eisenhower era when he was a president. So many, many decades ago. But I think the most logical solution near term from a capital perspective and from a societal perspective is countries that use nuclear power today, and there are many in their grid, can use that electricity or that power to produce hydrogen that could be used as the fuel for the future of the maritime industry. I think at present, at least, I think the capital investment to put nuclear power on commercial trading vessels is probably unobtainably high. But at the end of the day, I do believe in the energy density of nuclear power. I do believe it's a safe energy alternative. I know that's it carries a stigma, but certainly I think if we're not talking about it, then we're not talking about the whole problem.
Yeah, it's got to be part of the conversation, hasn't it? Even if we end up using other things, for sure. Now, I said at the top of the program, you have a digital background, and this is the bit I really wanted to get to today. So the simple question really is, what role do you think digital is going to play in the energy transition?
Thank you for getting to that. That's certainly my passion. I think digitization and digitalization, we talk about the difference if you like, has a huge role to play in decarbonization. And the reason for this is simple. Getting to decarbonization is about optimization. Mm-hmm. It's about smart decision-making. It's about engineering. And digitalization has a huge role to play in all of those things. So whether we're talking about decision-making and using tools to make decisions, the complexity of the problem, in my opinion, stretches beyond a Pareto analysis that an engineer is going to do in an Excel worksheet. It needs more sophisticated tools. And for the last couple of years, we've really been advocating what I would term 1D or kind of first principles multi-physics simulation as a pathway forward. Simulation can be a confusing word. People think about it as, well, like, we've been doing that forever. And yeah, to a degree, you know, I'm not talking about CFD. I'm not talking about finite element in this case, right? I'm talking about, you know, one line definitions of a problem set that we can then write do loops, if you want to use some older parlance, to go explore the trade space. And can I help my clients understand their CII or their EEXI scoring? Can I help them make techno-economic decisions, not only for a vessel, but for their fleet? Can I help them understand where they're going to compete relative to the rest of the world fleet, which is important when it comes to CII, especially using multi-physics sim? I think the answer to that question is yes, a robust yes. And so that's an exciting piece of digitalization where it plays a role in decarbonization. Mm-hmm. And of course, I've heard you talk I think even maybe it was two guests ago, about the role of streaming data and using data as a means to understand true optimization, and whether that comes into play with talking about weather routing, whether that talks in how we're dealing with the optimization of limiting your engine power to make sure that you are maximizing your efficiency on a voyage. That streaming data from all the rotating machinery, from all the pieces and parts on the vessel and off the vessel, to include your hindcast weather data, as well as your AIS positional data to maximize routing. I think that becomes a very, very important piece of the entire picture. Mm. As we talk about SIM and we talk about streaming data, we're starting to build up to something that is a buzzword in the industry. We talk about it all the time, this concept of the digital twin.
Yeah.
And where does the digital twin play in decarbonization? I think it has a very important role.
Glad you brought it up, because it was going to be my next question. This is a dream for an interview, this discussion.
Yeah, walking
a path. I mean, I have a background in data and modeling. You know, I did my master's degree in operational research. Modeling and forecasting is what my profession was. And I know that, you know, a model cannot include everything, because otherwise your model would be a twin of real life. So when we talk about digital twins, you know, there's got to be a limit to what you can model and what you can include in a simulation. So obviously, you want to include what's relevant and exclude what is irrelevant. And that is the boundary of the modeling challenge. But can a digital twin ever replace the variation we see, the dynamism we see in the real world environment? So, you know, a ship is operating in different sea states, different weather states. It's moving through the water 24 hours a day at a variable speed, or whatever the engine rating may say at the time, because of the different pressures from the atmosphere and the seas upon it, and so on.
Of course.
Is it possible to really recreate a viable digital twin that we can use to optimize shipping operations?
So that's quite a loaded question. So let me start with this. I started my career in simulation, and it was in computational mechanics. I was a CFD guy. I was a hydrodynamicist. And we had a phrase in my group. Again, I won't claim this. This came from someone else. I wish I could credit it. But all models are wrong. Some models are useful. Right? I'm sure people listening said, oh, I know that. He should know who said that. It was so-and-so, a mathematician. It escapes me.
I often tell people there's no such thing as a good forecast, only the least worst forecast.
That's right. And so I think the right way to think about that question is, okay, what do we do with a digital twin to make it useful? I don't necessarily, you know, stand in front of my organization and say, hey, we need to make this exactly right, right? What I say is, we need to find a way to maximize the value out of this. And that value, mm-hmm. whether it plays to safety, whether it plays to decarbonization or protection of the environment, or whether it plays to the economics, the real driving forcing factor of our client base to solve their challenges, that's where our focus needs to be. So when I think about digital twin models today, especially, what differentiates the models that I used to build, you know, 25, 30 years ago to what we're trying to do today is that connection to the real. So I would always build a model purely in abstraction. It was purely a mathematical estimation of what I expected the vessel to experience in its design life, yep. with no connection to the real world. And that's where things have really started to change. So you take your CFD model, you take your structural finite element model, you take your model of rotating machinery, your thermal model, your temperature pressure models, mm-hmm. all of your performance models, but then you connect them to the real thing. You connect them to streaming data off the engine. You connect them to the vibrations that you're seeing on the ship. You connect them to, and you start to validate, not only, you know, make your model more accurate, but make your model connected to the real. And then we start to apply technologies that I would guess you, but certainly I did not use 25 years ago in machine learning. Can I use that known data to predict a behavior that hasn't happened yet?
Yeah.
Whether that's, you know, we focus on maintenance and maintenance failure because that's like that low hanging fruit that we get. But I believe in my heart and in my head and in my gut that same technology has a very important role to play in the decarb question. That if I understand, you know, where my hull is behaving because of biofouling, if I understand where my engines are losing efficiency because of, you know, wearing linings or some other mechanical defect that needs to be addressed through maintenance, if I understand the performance of my flattener rotors, if I understand what my vessel is doing in a more intuitive and more predictive way, mm-hmm. because of digitalization, it will help me solve my carbon problem. And it will help me get my good CII scores, and it will help me get that economic driver that I ultimately need to be successful going into the future with all the uncertainty swirling around decarbonization.
That is a wonderful defense of digitalization. Thank you for that. No, I agree. I'm playing devil's advocate, as I'm sure you know. The digital twin, like the forecast, its utility lies in its utility in a way. That's tautologist, right. To say so. It's, you know, its usefulness is in how it can teach us about how we can optimize our efficiencies and manage our operations better. So for sure. I mean, it's great that we have people like yourself in the industry with your background and your expertise to help guide us through all this, because we need so many different skill sets to come together to reach this digitalization and this decarbonization challenge eventually, don't we?
Yeah, indeed. It's you know, when I made the transition from ship design and shipbuilding into this role at ABS, I couldn't have been more excited. You know, I was wanting that bigger impact, and certainly at ABS, we're excited to be helping the industry with this big gnarly problem of decarb.
Yep, it's one of the big two problems for this century. The other one I would suggest being the wider issue of ESG and how shipping gets to that, but that's a subject for another day.
Yes,
indeed. Patrick, we're coming to the end of our time, so thank you so much for taking the time to appear on the Ship.Energy podcast. Really appreciate you coming on and giving us the benefit of your insights and experience.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and call back anytime. I'd love to do it again.
Cheers. We may well get you back and have a further discussion to see how things are progressing in the future.
Very good.
But thank you again. And thank you to everybody out there in podcast land for listening, and keep your ears peeled for the next episode of the Ship.Energy podcast. But from sunny Cambridge in the UK, it's goodbye for now.